You're listening to the MLB Pipeline Podcast with your host, Ed Randall.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, and welcome to the MLB.com Pipeline Podcast. I'm joined by our draft and minor league expert, Jonathan Mayo. Jim Callis is away this week, so in his place, pinch hitting, Jesse Sanchez, our international expert. The 17th Sirius XM All-Star Futures game begins at 3 o'clock Eastern Time on July 12th. And can be seen here live on MLB.com as well as on the MLB Network. This feature began in 1999 in Fenway Park. Jonathan, I bet you have 1,000 memories of the Futures game, and you too, Jesse. So Jonathan, we'll start with you with some of the memories that have stood out through the years.
I thought about trying to do like a musical number here, Ed, kind of like a modern Major General kind of thing. But I don't think anybody really wants to hear me sing on this podcast. So I'll just throw out some of my favorite memories. And I think it has to start with that 1999 game. And I've been lucky. I've covered every single Futures game except for 2004 in Houston. I had a good excuse. My daughter was born then. So, but it started in 1999, and no one really knew what this game was going to be like. It was an experiment, a curiosity, maybe an afterthought. And then this skinny little shortstop from the Yankees minor league system hit two homers over the Green Monster. He went on to be Alfonso Soriano. And that kind of, I think that sort of gave the Futures game really good foundation. But a couple of other memories that really stand out. I remember in Seattle, Adam Dunn hit a homer off of the restaurant window in right field. I think it might still be traveling if the glass hadn't been in the way. And some of it is just the names that went on to be, you know, great names. 2002, Jose Reyes hit a base loaded triple. But I think what really stood out in that game is the world team closer was K-Rod. That summer and fall was the year that he came up and kind of, quote-unquote, came out of nowhere to help lead the Angels' bullpen in their World Series run. And it kind of goes on from there with so many other great performances. Billy Butler in 2006, Nick Castellanos in 2012. It goes on and on and on in terms of guys who have gone on to bigger and better things using the Futures game often as a springboard.
You know, it's amazing that you mentioned the 1999 inaugural game because I was executive producing a one-hour special on the flow of Latino players into baseball, a one-hour special called Baseball O Sueño Latino, and we had to pick one guy to follow, and we just threw a dart, and we decided on this shortstop from AA in the Yankee organization named, as you said, Alfonso Soriano, and he goes out and hits two homers and drives in five runs and gets the Most Valuable Player Award in the first Futures game. How lucky were we? Jesse, you've been in the world dugout for many of these games. Tell us about your memories.
Well, first of all, I'm so happy Jonathan did not sing that last list of great memories.
Speaking for all of us.
I'm going to sing to you in Cincinnati, Jesse.
Well, I wish I could say I'm looking forward to that, but I am not.
Jesse's also writing a theme song. He's writing a theme song for the MLB.com Pipeline Podcast. We're eagerly looking forward
anyway
to that. Yeah.
No, just being in the World Dugout, I mean, there's so many memories. Recently, what really sticks out is Colton Wong's enthusiasm, you know, him and seeing him in the dugout. I remember seeing Chu, you know, now the outfielder for the Rangers. You know, it seems like he played in four Futures games. You know, and there are so many of these players just in the dugout. What really stands out to me is seeing these guys from the Dominican, Venezuela, different Asian countries, Canada, Brazil, everybody just getting along in the dugout, goofing around. Sometimes there's a language barrier. Sometimes there's not. And they're just, you know, having a good old time, you know. And what I really take away from that whole experience is just how much fun they're having, but how competitive it is. And just being behind the scenes in that world dugout, you can see all these guys goof around in between pitches, in between innings. But during the game, I mean, they are so serious. They want to win. They want to beat the, you know, the USA team. And, you know, it's all business. I mean, it's a great event, and I really feel happy to be in that World Dugout. And I'm also sorry I could not sing the way Jonathan Mayo probably would have sang that.
Jesse, July 2nd was the start of the international signing period. The Yankees, for one, were said to have a very successful signing period last year, spending a ton of money, but this year not so much. Not the case with, to name two, the Dodgers and Giants. Tell us about this year's winners and losers in the international marketplace.
Probably the biggest name, the biggest winners of the entire July 2nd period would have to be the Los Angeles Dodgers. You know, they signed Yadier Alvarez, our number two ranked player on their international prospect list, for $16 million. They signed Starling Heredia, ranked number five. They signed Ronnie Brito, ranked number 21. You know, another good player named Christopher Arias, a shortstop named O'Neill Cruz, for $950,000. The Dodgers really went for it this year. Obviously, they're going to go into the penalty, and it's basically going to be double what they're paying because they're paying, you know, 100% tax. But they decided to go for it. They're also in on the number one player on our, you know, top 30 international prospect list, and that's Eddie Julio Martinez. They're one of the favorites to sign him. The Dodgers are really going strong in the international market, and I think they're kind of feel like they can fill out their minor league rosters, hopefully land a couple of big stars, and they feel it's worth the investment. I think another team that probably came out on top was the San Francisco Giants. They signed a player named Lucius Fox. It's a player Jonathan pretty familiar with. They signed him for $6 million. Another team that did well was the Toronto Blue Jays signing Vladimir Guerrero Jr. So that's going to be a name to watch now and then going forward in the future, just because his name, you know, the family pedigree. He obviously has a great skill set. He's probably the best 16-year-old in the world right now. And That's a team I'm going to watch. That's a player I'm going to watch. It's really hard to say who are the losers. I guess if we want to separate it that way, we could say a team like, you know, the Red Sox, who are only limited to 300,000 this year, or the Yankees, who are only limited to 300,000, you know, per player because of the signing. But it's even hard to say they're going to be losers because, you know, the big signing bonus doesn't automatically mean that player is going to be, you know, exponentially better than the players who don't sign. But for the Red Sox, you know, they signed a couple of players for $300,000, a guy named Alberto Guaymaro, an outfielder from Venezuela. They signed another outfielder named Simone Muziati. So I guess in some regards you can say, hey, they only signed these guys for only $300,000. How good that can they be? But in another regard you can say, you know, they kind of did a good job. They signed these guys for only $300,000, and they're going to contribute to their system.
Well, you know, the examples I always use, you know, being here in Pittsburgh is, you know, the Pirates signed Starling Marte and Gregory Polanco for, I think, a combined $100,000 or $150,000. So you can find value. I'm curious, Jesse, how much the decisions that these teams make, the Yankees last year, you look at the Dodgers this year, how much work is done, like, looking ahead at next year's class in determining, well, we're going to go all in this year? Like, did the Yankees say, well, we liked the group last year much better than what's coming, so we're going to go nuts a year ago, while clearly this year the Dodgers thought, all right, this is the year to do it, and next year's class doesn't look good? Or is it just looking at this year's talent and saying, all right, we like what we have in front of us, and we'll worry about next year?
You know, I think it's both. But I do think there's tons of advance work. To get such a big haul like the Yankees did last year with almost 30 prospects, to grab such, you know, all the premier players, or, you know, five or six of the premier players like the Dodgers did this year, there's a lot of advance work going on. You know, they're saying, we're going for it this year. Maybe next year's class isn't as good. So let's go ahead and, you know, get as many players as we can now, go into the penalty, and we can still sign players for $300,000 or less next year. And I think that comes into the, you know, the legwork leading up to, you know, the international signing period. You know, right now the reality is clubs are already looking into the 2016s. You know, player, they're looking at July 2nd, 2016 right now, leading up to, you know, even leading up to this year's July 2nd period, many clubs are already spinning forward, making decisions. How are we going to approach next year? What is the talent like in Venezuela? What's the talent like in the Dominican Republic? Are we going to go use this Dodgers and Yankee strategy and spend all of our allotment and go into the penalty? Is it worth it? I mean, there's so many things that go into these decisions. It's definitely they evaluate early, and it's pretty hard to lock these guys down. I mean, it's pretty hard to come to agreements with these teams, with these players so far in advance. It's pretty difficult to, you know, evaluate, make this decision. So they, it's a long process. It takes several months. But it's something teams like the Dodgers and Yankees feel was necessary. And here we go. We're going to just see if these players end up, you know, playing out and they develop into the kind of prospects they hope they are.
And, Jesse, as you spoke about last week, the penalties don't seem to be a sufficient deterrent for teams like the Dodgers to go sign these guys or the buckets full of players that the Yankees signed last year.
You know, I think in general, I think the perception is, you know, the penalties, they just don't work. But I'm just not sure how accurate that is. I mean, it definitely deters some of the mid-market teams and the low-market teams who cannot afford to pay the penalty, you know, 100% overage on your entire, you know, the money you spend, you know, not being able to sign a player for $300,000 or more. You know, that definitely affects some clubs. But we have seen, you know, the trend says the big market teams, whether it's the Cubs, who did it a couple years ago, the Rangers, who did it a couple years ago, Yankees, Dodgers, it doesn't seem to affect them, and they're willing to pay the penalty. I know the perception is it doesn't work, but maybe for 25 of the 30 teams it does. It's just the teams that, you know, blow past the penalty and pay the penalty, it's just such an extreme investment that it just, you know, people raise their eyebrows and like, wow, what is going on over there?
On another matter, the Cuban national team was in Durham, then in Charlotte, to play a five-game friendship series against Team USA, and our team did quite well, Jonathan.
It's a whole, they're calling it what, America's Baseball Festival, right, Jesse?
Right.
Yeah, so you had the Pan Am team, the pre-Pan Am team, which is professionals playing Team Canada. They won that game 9-3. And then the college team played Cuba. Jesse, you called that game last night?
Yes.
And Cuba won that game, and that's the last of that series. But now Cuba's going to play the, I want to make sure I get this right, Cuba's going to play the professional pre-Pan Am team tonight at 7 o'clock. I have all the information correct?
All right. Correct.
Well, see, I'm right every once in a while. I think it's an exciting, you know, time. It's always a good time of year down in Cary, North Carolina. We had the Tournament of Stars, the high school guys, and then the college team has been there for a while. They played a bunch of games against Cuba. You know, Jesse, you got to see them firsthand. I'm curious what your takeaways were from that Cuban team so far.
Just, you know, just talking, just watching them, talking to some scouts in attendance, and even to the coaches and Cuban players and the manager, you know, they're the first to admit this isn't the strongest team they've, you know, the strongest national team they've ever had. I mean, they won't go out of its way to say it's their weakest, but it's just definitely not one of the strongest, and there are tons of factors that go into that. The way it was explained to me is, you know, the Cuban National Series, the league they play in called the City Nacional, it's been depleted. There have been so many different players, whether it's elite players like Jose Abreu, Aroldis Chapman, Cespedes, Puig, the elite players have gone. You know, they've left Cuba, so they left that league. And now there's an entire wave of young players leaving Cuba. So what's left is a league struggling to survive. Yes, there's talent there, and yes, it's kind of peppered with, you know, talent on different teams. But, you know, from, you know, top to bottom, this isn't the Cuban league that it used to be, it reflects in the national team. So what you're seeing here is teams that are not used to facing pitchers that throw 92, 93. You know, the Cuban team was no hit in its very first game. in this friendly series. They were shut out in the second game, you know. So, and they were basically being dominated by pitching. So I asked the manager what's going on, and he was just, and his explanation was, we just are not used to seeing these type of pitching all the time. Even our best pitching is 89 to 91 with breaking balls and sliders and changeups. We're not used to the velocity, you know, the American kids are throwing at us. And it, you know, and part of the reason is everybody's leaving. We're still proud and we're still strong and we're still doing our best. But the reality is this isn't the Cuban national team that most people are used to seeing, because those players are either in the United States now or they're in Dominican Republic or Haiti or Mexico working on getting to the United States.
Jesse, two players, I understand, just last week during this tournament defected. So there is a situation where they are depleted, and the no-hit game was unprecedented. A Cuban national team had never been no-hit. And in another game, they lost 11-1, largest margin of defeat ever. So whereas we once viewed this team as the equivalent of the Russian hockey team, things are quite different now with these with this Cuban national team.
Definitely. And, you know, there's a couple different ways to look at those defections. And I think everybody on the Cuban team, whether it's the players, whether it's the coaches, the managers, you know, they have government officials there. You know, they get it. Some players want to leave Cuba. They want to seek a different life. They're willing to leave their families behind, and they understand that. I mean, it's been happening. You know, Fidel Castro has been in power since 1959. So a lot of things have happened, you know, over the past 50-something years. So they're not, it's not foreign for them to have, you know, people and players leave. But their sentiment, strictly from a baseball side, is they're upset because they feel like they're being shorthanded, like they're left shorthanded, like their bench is two players short now. Now we have guys playing out of position because you decided to leave us. I mean, it's obviously a lot more complex than that, but broken down base from the baseball side, you know, the manager, the coaches, the government officials here with Cuba, they're like, okay, now what we're going to do? We're going to play a Team USA that's really loaded. We're going to play a team from Canada that's really loaded, and we lost two of our best guys. Now what?
Very good point. Jonathan, closing thoughts?
No, I'm just excited to get to Cincinnati. Every year we bring some Futures game guys in early, do a little tour around town, and this year we've got a kid who's from Cincinnati originally, Kyle Schwarber, you know, the Cubs prospect who made his major league debut a couple weeks ago, and a guy who hopes to be pitching in Cincinnati, Amir Garrett, who a lot of people might remember is a guy who played basketball at St. John's before finally focusing on baseball full-time. So we're going to run around with them on Friday. The rest of the Futures gamers come in on Saturday, so we'll have a lot of good video content as guys come in. And then the game itself on Sunday, and I'm happy to be part of the broadcast again, so we should have a good time.
And we're happy to have you, and it is the 17th Sirius XM All-Star Futures game. Begins at 3 o'clock Eastern on July 12th and can be seen here live on MLB.com as well as on the MLB Network. Jesse, great job pinch hitting. Thanks so much for being with us. Jonathan, enjoy all the All-Star festivities in Cincinnati. I'm Ed Randall. Thanks for listening, everybody, to the MLB.com Pipeline Podcast.